Hello, I'm John Butler, Investment Director at South Bank Investment Research. And I'm joined this morning I'm in England, Nick is in Japan, to discuss the results of the election that we've just had overnight. Well, as it happens, I went to sleep in a blue district and I've woken up in a red district. And I know that many of you watching this have gone through the exact same experience overnight. We're in probably the single largest constituency group in the country, as it were, moving from blue to red in that way. Nick's perspective naturally is going to be somewhat different, having watched this election from afar. And yet we went into this election with Nick having a very interesting view about what the results would mean, or rather not mean, for the UK economy, for financial markets, and for your personal financial future. So Nick, please, if you'd like to elaborate on just what we now know has happened and how that does or does not conform to your predictions for this election and what it means, please let our viewers know.
Yeah, my prediction is that the election won't actually matter terribly much. But I think before we dig into that, we should take a look at what actually happened overnight for you, during the day for me here in Japan. What I'm thinking this amounts to is a sort of fragile landslide, the idea being that Labour won a massive majority in terms of seats in Parliament, but in terms of vote share, in terms of the margins in some of those electorates, it was a very different story. And so to me, the real message is all about the next election and how the recent election sets up the next election. And the question is going to be, you know, what those margins and what the entrance of reform into Parliament is going to mean in the next election, and how Labour is and isn't going to be able to govern this Parliament because of what happens in the next election. So I think it was really because it was almost a foregone conclusion that Labour would win by a large majority, I think it was all about the smaller details and how they're going to impact the subsequent electoral cycle.
But when you say that Labour's not really going to be able to govern, does that mean that this result and the state of the country might look something like things were in the 1970s, when Labour made some grand promises, but in the end were unable to do very much because of the financial constraints that were effectively being imposed on the country by the financial markets?
And if I get my history right here, they blame that on the previous Conservative government's budget with the high inflation and the mad pro-growth policies that were not actually similar to what Liz Truss did, but similar in terms of the net impact on borrowing. So I think that analogy works really well. I have a suspicion that actually the IMF is the one very much in charge of economic policy, not just in the UK, but across Europe at the moment. The reason being they're running incredible amounts of debt again. And so when countries get into that sort of a debt trap where the usual tax and spending policies that might solve a budget crisis no longer look like they're going to work, you know, the usual austerity programs no longer look like they're going to work, then all of a sudden you need some more drastic action. And that's what the IMF is pushing in places like Greece and Portugal and Spain that we're very much familiar with. But now also because of the debts that we racked up during the pandemic, also in the UK.
Well, does that mean then that notwithstanding what is on paper, at least a very large majority, we're going to have 5 more years of something that doesn't look all that dissimilar from the last few post-COVID, post-lockdown years of the Conservatives? That is, we're already bearing a larger tax burden outside of wartime than we ever have. Obviously, the debt servicing costs have gone up as interest rates have gone up and the debt has grown. You're now in a situation where it seems that the country under the Conservatives already ended up in a very unpleasant place where, on the one hand, you have, you know, Scandinavian levels of taxation, but you have, you know, what might be Brazilian levels of social services or something like that. And I don't really think that's what the electorate would ever have wanted. I mean, who would? But that's where we got to under the Conservatives. And it seems we're just in for 5 more years of something along those lines. I mean, what will Labour be able to do, if anything, to have any chance of remaining in power for a sustained period of time, say the way Blair and Brown were able to prior?
Yeah, it's a question of degree, right? If they try and do anything radical, then exactly what happened to Liz Truss happened to Keir Starmer. They know there is a constraint out there. And so they're going to be probably very slowly pushing the envelope if they want to at all. Now, I'm not sure that they want to at all. I'm wondering whether, you know, this boring style works so well for them during the election. It might work for them in government as well, and people don't want any more of the chaos that we've had, not just during election cycle, but also during government. I've always wondered how a political party that promises to change absolutely nothing would fare in an election cycle. I guess conventional political theory would say it would be a disaster because people always want governments to solve problems. But I'm sure you would agree, John, that governments actually cause more problems than they can possibly solve. And so maybe a political party that suggests, let's not change anything for 5 years and see how we go, see what happens, might succeed. And so maybe Sir Keir Starmer will be channeling that sort of energy just as he did during the election. You know, it has worked in terms of seats. It might not have brought out the voter turnout or the level of voter support that Labour might want. But if Labour had actually promised the big sorts of changes that we'd associate with a Labour government, probably they would have lost some of those votes towards perhaps even the Conservatives or to reform. And some of those scare stories that we've seen over the last few weeks about Labour policies might have actually been more true.
Right, right. Well, one thing that you mentioned to me several weeks ago following a discussion you had with Nigel Farage was that the real danger here was that Labour would only squeak through with a very small majority, such that the more radical, say, farther left wing of the party would have disproportionate influence when it came to a difficult vote on, you know, whatever policy it might be. Whereas now, it looks like we have a fairly comfortable majority. So as you say, that gives Starmer and the other front benchers perhaps a little bit more latitude to try and govern more generally for the country as a whole, rather than pander to some of the more radical elements, fringe elements of the party.
And we saw that happen for the Conservatives, especially under Liz Truss, where the Red Wall seat holders from the Conservatives didn't want any sort of radical big changes or pro-free market policies because it would have upset their constituencies. That's now reversed. So the Labour Party can't pursue these hard left type policies without upsetting what is now, because of the size of this majority, very large moderate base in Parliament. And you know, they can't be held to ransom in the same way that you might say a coalition government can. We know where the one junior partner effectively has a veto power. I think Nigel was right when he said that actually, if you want to have a more conservative type government, more New Labour type government, your best bet is to have a large Labour majority so that they cannot be held to ransom by the left. Unless, of course, Sir Keir Starmer is, you know, the secret socialist that some people are claiming, and that he really will try and change the country. In which case, I think we can rely on the bond market and some shady dealings inside the bond market to try and rein him in. The only possible exception to that that I can see is if the Green New Deal net zero type policy becomes a massive part of Labour's policy plans, then I think central bankers might actually be willing to support the government in the bond market in order to get that sort of spending over the line under all sorts of weird terminologies and justifications. We know climate change has sort of more or less directly been included in the central bankers' mandate these days. So it is possible that if Labour do focus on the green side, they won't find themselves offside in financial markets. But I think that that's unlikely given how well green policies and net zero policies are doing with the electorates across all of the world, I'd say now.
Well, you raise an interesting point. I mean, first of all, the context here is of an absolutely massive debt burden, certainly in this country, and as you've mentioned, elsewhere in Europe. That does give the central banks disproportionate power because they're involved in financing and rolling over that debt burden. And as we saw last year, of course, that power was used very, very effectively to dispatch the Truss-Quartang plan to try and implement a kind of Reagan-Thatcher-esque supply-side program of an unfunded tax cut, basically. So that didn't last very long, as we know. But you mentioned now the green side of things and the fact that central bankers are involved in that. There have been discussions at the ECB and at the IMF already that perhaps central banks should consider some sort of two-tier financing policy going forward. That is, government spending plans that qualify as green actually get funded by the central bank at a lower rate than those that are deemed non-compliant, non-green, or whatever it is. So that is an idea that's already being floated around, and certainly given the orientation, we believe, of the financial elite and the Bank of England in this country, they might well think along similar lines, no?
Yeah, that's what I'm worried about, because that gives them the excuse to continue supporting government spending in the same way that they did during the pandemic, during the financial crisis, and so on and so forth. This idea that, you know, Liz Truss got into trouble in the bond market because the Bank of England refused to bail her out. And usually when bond markets crash in the way that they did during the Truss government, and also before the Truss government, the Bank of England will step in and try and prevent that. And what it actually did was the exact opposite. It actually announced that it was going to sell bonds, and it raised interest rates the day before the mini budget. So Liz Truss found herself offside in financial markets because of a lack of support from the Bank of England. Now, if debts had been very low in the UK, then it wouldn't have needed the Bank of England support. But we're past that threshold now. Any sort of significant change in government policy could cause trouble in the bond market, which creates the question for the Bank of England. Is this some sort of emergency or crisis that justifies the Bank of England supporting the government spending? Or is this, you know, the wrong sort of government spending that we don't like because it's too free market or too socialist or whatever it might be? And green financing, they've been signaling for a very long time now. You know, it fits within the box of, yeah, we're happy to finance that. Just as, for example, during the European sovereign debt crisis, when governments were following the European Central Bank, IMF, and the EU line, then the European Central Bank supported them in bond markets. As soon as any government started to fight against austerity, whatever the policy proposal was from the IMF and EU and ECB, that's when they started to get into trouble. And the implication is it's because the European Central Bank would stop supporting that government when it made those policy decisions. And I guess the context of all of this is that it really implies we don't really have much of a democracy in our system anymore, because, you know, what voters vote for and what politicians propose is still subject to the approval of central bankers, because we're in so much debt that any sort of significant change requires their support to avoid a crisis in bond market.
Well, one concern I have is that now that we've got the election behind us, but as you say, with this historically unprecedented outside of wartime debt burden, and some of the precedents that have been set now by central bankers to intervene more directly in national and international financial matters, public finance matters. If the economy isn't really growing, and let's face it, it's not. You know, growth has been near zero for the past year and a half or so. And the outlook is that, if anything, we might tip back into a recession later this year or next. If an economy is not growing, but the public sector desperately needs to be able to fund that huge debt burden, where is the money going to come from? It's going to come from somewhere.
That's an easy answer. I can tell you exactly what the answer to that is. It's immigration. There's only few ways to grow the economy. One's productivity growth, and one is, of course, to bring in more people, either to give birth to more people or to bring in more people via immigration. And I suspect this is why immigration was allowed to surge so far out of control under so many governments around the West. And it's a very long list, by the way, and they all share this same problem and the same electoral consequences in their polling. It's not difficult to try and cut down on immigration, be it legal or illegal is irrelevant. It's not difficult for governments to do that. They've chosen not to, even though it causes electoral wipeouts. What explains that? Well, if we didn't have the immigration, what would our GDP look like right now? I think it would be a disastrous recession. I think that without all of these new people being imported, GDP growth would be terrible. And there's a lot of evidence from that in the fact that we've had per capita recessions. So if we measure GDP per person, there's been a lot of recessions around the world, a lot more frequently than there have been when you measure aggregate GDP, meaning once you include all everyone together. The distinction there has been immigration. And so that's why I think that the politicians have been willing to go against their electorate because they fear, first of all, what a recession will do to them politically, and they have judged that the recession will be worse than having too much immigration. And secondly, because without proving that they're willing to grow their economy via immigration, they would have a debt crisis, just like Liz Truss did.
Well, it's not exactly a pretty picture overall, but let's consider some of the regional results in this election. If you take a look at the map of the UK now, it would appear that the Conservatives are now strictly an English party. I don't believe they have a single constituency now in Wales. And you've had no ability of the Conservatives to benefit from the implosion of the Scottish National Party up north. And indeed, the Conservative partners in Northern Ireland, the DUP, well, guess what? They've lost out now to Sinn Féin. So really, the Conservative Party is now an English party, and we effectively have other parties governing the other regions of the United Kingdom. Do you see any significant political fallout from that going forward?
I guess the worry is for unionism and all that. But from my limited understanding, I've lived in Scotland for a few years. I lived in Ireland, Republic of Ireland, for a few years as a child. It seems to me that local politics is quite peculiar in each of those places. And so local issues can be quite important. And so, you know, the fact that the SNP votes tumbled so much and Labour's replaced them to the extent they have is to do with the local issues in Scotland. And it's almost a coincidence that it's, you know, in sync with what's happened for Labour in the rest of the country as well. And it's exaggerated their gains quite a bit. It's very difficult to know how that extends now in the future for Scotland, because you can't really see the Conservatives trying to do massive inroads in Scotland or Northern Ireland for that matter. So I think it's incredibly difficult to figure out how the United Kingdom electoral system and the changes in the news in it impacted what happened within each of those electorates. And maybe we'll get a lot more information on that from their national elections within Scotland in the next, I think it's the next few years. So we'll find out what happens there. And it's kind of a bizarre situation, isn't it, to have these local issues play such a large role in the United Kingdom's electoral system. And it would have been a very strange election, right, if there had been a variation between what was going on in Scotland and what was going on in England, to the sense that, you know, say the SNP rose rather than Labour falling, or vice versa, so that the two offset each other, and you had this large national trend. But what happened to occur in Scotland, for no reasons that were not related to the national trend, you know, offset that shift. It would be expose the electoral system as being dysfunctional in a whole other way.
No, fair point. Well, look, I understand that you reached out over the course of this week to Fortune and Freedom readers and asked them whether they had any specific thoughts or questions that they would maybe like an answer to coming out of the actual election results that we now have. Are there any of those that you would like to share with our audience today?
Yeah, thanks for all the emails that came in. I've selected, I think, three or four that I want to go into. They're sort of representative of the average mails that came in. The first one is very simple. Does it matter? Do we shoot ourselves now? And my advice is obviously not shoot yourself. It's not going to help you very much. What I find peculiar about this election is that it matters, but we don't yet know how. So Labour now have this difficult choice between what they pursue and whether they actually live up to their promises, which is where, of course, the Conservatives went wrong. They didn't actually do what they say they were going to do. And none of the possible paths that they might want to take really serve them especially well, right? So they could pursue some sort of far left or green agenda, and that would go down very badly with lots of electorates that would swing back to the Conservatives or Reform in the next election. They could be very boring and not do much, in which case they sort of alienate their own followers. They could try and, you know, reverse Brexit to some extent, which would reverse the Red Wall's, you know, support. So I don't think there's no path of least resistance for Labour, which makes it very difficult to predict what they're going to end up doing. And whichever one they do choose, I think is going to determine how we see this election result, what meaning it had and how it changed the UK. It's all yet to be determined. A bit like after Brexit, we didn't know what Brexit we were going to get. It was all yet to be determined. Next reader question I want to answer here is, where do we go from here? We have a country hamstrung by excessive debt. and a Conservative government incapable of achieving necessary changes to effect a positive change in our circumstances. On the other hand, we have a Socialist Party who will never do anything positive because they never have. My response to that is that I suspect what's going on in the UK and also in France with the early election has a specific purpose. And I'm not the only one saying this. We had this surprise early election in both places. People didn't really see coming. And I'm getting worried that it's because some sort of negative economic or political or geopolitical news is coming down the track. And so both the leaders in France and the UK, I was actually getting worried about Germany today because the coalition there had its meeting to determine what it wants to do in the future. But that went okay in the end. Nevertheless, I think those elections were called early because something bad's coming down the pipeline. Now, I don't know what it is. Could be an energy crisis, could be trying to settle with Ukraine in a way that's going to be very unpopular, given the way that conflict has been portrayed in the media and by the government. Could be something to do with vaccines, could be all sorts of issues. And I think politicians needed to get the election in before that to have any hope of having a good result. Hasn't worked out that well for either of them. But I think that is one possible explanation for where do we go from here. The other way we could go from here is that Labour gets into some sort of financial trouble or carefully avoids pursuing any interesting policies that might get it into financial trouble. And so the possibility there is that we're going to have extremely boring 5 years, deliberately or not, and under pressure from the likes of the IMF and the Bank of England or not. Not much will happen to surprise anyone. If it does, I suspect it would be a buying opportunity for investors because the central banks of the world have been very successful at bringing populist governments and wayward governments to heel whenever they try and pursue something that is not considered to be financially sound.
No, that's very true. And indeed, thinking about these things, all of what you just mentioned from an investor's point of view, it does look like a challenging set of circumstances to be sure. But to some extent, as you say, if in fact the net result here is more continuity, more of what we've kind of been seeing in recent years anyway, then the markets should have really just got it all priced in by now. That is, the idea that somehow the market's going to crash because Labour has a large majority does not line up with what you're saying. Now, that said, if there is bad news coming down the pipe, and that's bad economic news, presumably in part, if not only bad economic news, then yes, of course, financial markets might react. But the idea that somehow this election is the specific cause of that does not seem particularly relevant to me. Would you agree?
Yeah, and the question is what the market's pricing in, right? Is it pricing in some sort of Labour surprise policies, or is it surprising in that boredom and that continuity? But the point is that Labour's in a real political pickle, right? Because as I mentioned just earlier, there's no real obvious path that will actually gain them any sort of popularity in the subsequent election. Each possible choice that they could make gets them into trouble with some part of the electorate. And to the extent that this is a protest vote, then you know, that protest will fade. But the lack of surprises has that caveat that the Labour government could try something. They might not have learned from the likes of Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng. They could try and do something. But even if that occurs, I think that will be the buying opportunity because they will be brought back to toe the line by the bond market.
Gotcha. Got you. Well, great, Nick. Thanks for your thoughts. Before we go, is there anything else that you'd like to mention to our viewers today?
Let's go with one more reader question here. This one okay. I found quite interesting because it challenges the orthodoxy of how we see the different political parties. Who is going to be the party of business growth, incentivizing risk-taking, job creation, and adding value to the economy? Since the Tories, well, Rishi as Chancellor, lowered the entrepreneur lifetime allowance from £10 million to £1 million, you know, that doesn't look like it supports entrepreneurialism. The reader also says, I sit weekly in the pub with a lot of entrepreneurs and property owners, most of them in their 50s, and none of us can see anything promising coming our way. At least Starmer has acknowledged that businesses create the value that drives the economy, but what will he or can he do to get us growing again? Like I said, the Conservatives have reached to immigration to try and generate that growth. And I just don't see how Labour, short of pursuing Liz Truss type reforms, which are undermined by the bond market, can come up with much else in terms of growth. And maybe whatever it is that's coming down the pipeline is a recession. And that's why this election was called so early. So I'm very worried about that pro-growth, pro-entrepreneurialism. However, there is nothing like a Labour government, an experience with a Labour government, to bring back the Conservatives in the way that they should be, and that pro-free market, pro-entrepreneurialism, pro-tax incentive form that they're supposed to actually be upholding according to their ideology. So maybe, you know, what you need is a few years of a Labour government just to get, you know, the awakening, a bit like happened with Thatcher. The problem is it could cost us a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of GDP, and potentially even a financial crisis. Perhaps the electorate will wake up more to the risk if there is some sort of financial crisis under Labour. It won't be as easy to sort of stow it away as crazy Liz Truss a second time around.
Well, as with history generally, politics does go in cycles. We do see that. And indeed, the Greeks saw that. The Greeks believed, for example, that democracy was but one stage of a political cycle that also included aristocracy, that also included tyranny. They felt that that was the natural order of things. And I hope that things perhaps don't get quite that dark in our future. That is the cycle that we're in. I hope remains a more benign one than that. But as you say, there's nothing like the experience of a properly left-leaning Labour government to focus the mind and give the electorate the opportunity to maybe make some more difficult choices next time around, rather than perhaps just believe in whatever promises were proffered the last time around. It looks like, however, this Labour government, at least initially, is probably unlikely to try to move the country dramatically to the left. And as you say, if they did, they might just find they bump right up against the Bank of England and the bond market before they hardly even get started. So I think that's a very helpful perspective, Nick. Thank you for sharing it with our viewers today. I'm sure more questions will be coming your way. And of course, we are going to learn over the coming weeks what the initial set of Labour's policy proposals will actually be. So I hope you enjoyed watching this today. I hope you enjoyed Nick's unique perspective, which again, he was way ahead of the curve on all of this, if you ask me. And we look forward to speaking with you about the election and, of course, other financial market and investment-related matters soon. I'm John Butler, Investment Director for South Bank Investment Research.